The 1970s bring some of the worst times, the best times, and the weirdest times in Celtics history. And we're going to talk about them starting today on this Tuesday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go! Rainy J's back with the vengeance. Back. All the real Celtics fans in attendance. This the truth like 34. This like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. Crowd goes crazy, most in-depth coverage on the daily, mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings, focus like Danny at the deadline, global with it, got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line, play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day, trying to stay in tune with the C's, that's the best way. Melly. Hey there, John Corrales here from MassLive.com, back with our historical deep dive into Boston Celtics franchise history. We are now on the 1970s, and this is, as you just heard in my cold open, a just wild decade. So much happens in this decade. We'll set it up. They lose the era of dominance, that decade of greatness, it's over. Tommy Heinsohn comes in, and they get back to the mountaintop. Then they all fall apart again. Some legends come and go. One of their legends decides to take a break, drive a taxi in the middle of it. And then at the end of the decade, the owner trades franchises with another team. So that all happens in the 1970s. In this episode, we kind of get the beginning, the first couple of years, the transition. So the Celtics dynasty comes to an end. Bill Russell is gone. Sam Jones is gone. Havlicek becomes the star. And we start getting the foundation for the next generation of Celtics greats, Hall of Famers, JoJo White among them. And in this episode, you get a great JoJo White story from Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com. This is his era. This is when he was watching the Celtics closely, there at games, seeing all of this stuff firsthand. So really, as I'll say in the podcast, the 70s are kind of a lost decade for the NBA, for the Boston Celtics. I mean, the league almost fails in the 1970s. And it's not until Larry Bird and Magic Johnson come along that the entire league gets rejuvenated. The interest comes back. And people might not really realize some of the great players or great stories that were involved in the 1970s. So Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com is going to share a lot of that. And we're going to get you through the first couple of years in this podcast and then walk you through the rest as we move forward. Again, if this is your first time listening and you missed the 60s, yeah, you can always binge that and go to last week, Tuesday through Friday, and get the 60s. And then prior to that, the 1950s, the birth of the Boston Celtics, Red Auerbach, a lot of luck that was involved building this team. And there's still some luck in the 70s. And then there's Red Auerbach pulling just some wildly shrewd moves again, starting with JoJo White. And how he got JoJo White based on his military service. So let's start there with Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com.
All right, Mike, thanks for coming back.
We're now, hey, John.
This is your wheelhouse, baby. 1970s basketball, 1970s Celtics. This is like, I feel like the 70s are the lost decade in the NBA as a whole.
Yeah, you know, that's there's a lot of truth to that, because you had the 60s, which was the glory decade for the Celtics and Celtics fans, and the 80s, where you needed Larry Bird and Magic Johnson to sort of rescue the league. The 70s, they were showing finals games on tape delay at 11 p.m. That's not a good thing for the health of your league. So, yeah, I see what you mean about the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, so there's this whole era. There's, you know, the cocaine epidemic comes in and really derails a lot of careers. There's the ABA, which as this league is starting, that its first season was at the end of the 60s. So as we now transition into the 1969-1970 season, the ABA is starting to emerge as somewhat of a competitor. They struggle, but whatever. But running concurrent with all of the stuff that we're talking about is an ABA that has an exciting brand of basketball that is sapping viewership away from the NBA, that really kind of hurts the league until they end up merging in 1976. But let's start with what is a transition year. 1969-1970, we talked about it at the end of the last podcast. Bill Russell is gone. Sam Jones has retired. The Celtics, as we know them, are gone. Tommy Heinsohn now takes over for, and the Celtics go 34-48 in that first season under Tommy Heinsohn, who becomes a Hall of Fame coach. They end up missing the playoffs for like the first time in 20 years.
The whole 1970s was like a bell curve for the Celtics. Because the decade started, they missed the playoffs two seasons. Then they had six seasons where they were fantastic. They set a team record for wins. They won two titles. And then the last 2 years of the decade, they missed the playoffs again. So you really had up and down there. And the NBA expanded. They were at 14 teams by 1969-70. But the Celtics went through so much turmoil in that decade. They had major trades, coaching changes. They had a top player taking a sabbatical. They had two owners traded the entire franchises. And Red made one of the greatest moves that he ever made.
So that's a nice overview of the decade. It is a wild decade. I mean, so much, like you just laid out, happened. So let's start here in that 69-70 season. Tommy Heinsohn comes in. It's not all bad for the Celtics. They bring in Tommy. They drafted JoJo White. You've got John Havlicek kind of coming into his own and seizing the role of star player. He becomes the unquestioned number one guy in this season moving forward. And then a weird thing that Bob Cousy actually comes back and gets traded to Cincinnati.
Yeah. I wonder if the Cous regretted doing that. He was coaching, just the background, he was coaching Cincinnati, the Royals, who are now the Kings, and he decided, probably for the purpose of selling tickets, that he was going to be a player coach. He was 40, 41 years old. And so when he said this, though, Red, being Red, wasn't going to let that pass. He still owned the rights to Bob Cousy. He and the Celtics did. So he forced Cincinnati to give up a player for Bob Cousy, and that player was Bill Dinwiddie, who didn't end up doing much for the Celtics, but it was just the principle of the thing.
Sure.
And it's not the only time Red ever did that. He did it later a couple of times with other players.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But just in what you were talking about with the Celtics, where they were, you know, like who they had playing with them, they were in transition because they were going to have to start a youth movement behind Havlicek. Havlicek, as you said, was definitely the man. And they had a bunch of role players who had performed well in championship settings when they had Bill Russell. But, you know, now without Russell, without Sam Jones, the role players have to move up one level. And mostly they couldn't do it. But they did have some pieces starting to come into place. As you mentioned, JoJo White was a rookie. Don Chaney was in his second year. That was their backcourt of the future.
You're a big Chaney fan, right? Is that right?
I love Don Chaney. He's on Twitter. Picture of him is my avatar.
Yeah.
He He's played the style of play that I played in the schoolyards. I was never much of a basketball player personally, but I could play defense and block shots. I have long arms. I couldn't shoot, and that was Don Chaney. So I naturally admired his game. And so also, he was a good guy. I was in college when he was in his first years with the Celtics, and I was taking a photography course, and we had to do some action photos. So I took a picture of him at a game, and then I printed the picture in the photo lab and brought it to a game and got him to sign it. He was very nice. And Cedric Maxwell talks about him because Cedric was a teammate and played for Don Chaney as a coach. And Cedric always says how great of a person Don Chaney is. So, yeah, I do like him. And back where of the 70s, at least the first half of the 70s, was Chaney and JoJo.
So Chaney comes in. He's drafted in 1968. And then he joins JoJo White. JoJo White joins the team a year later. And so that's your backcourt.
Right. JoJo had a military commitment. You know, we had the military draft back then.
Yeah.
It was the Vietnam War era. And so JoJo was an All-American. He had won an Olympic gold. But he didn't get drafted as one of the top picks. He was picked in the first round by the Celtics, but the ninth pick. And I think some teams might have been hesitant to take him because of that draft commitment. But Red, knowing people, having connections, did something, I guess, to help that along, because JoJo ended up in the Marine Reserves. And he only missed part of his rookie year, the first couple of months. After that, I think he had to occasionally be away for reserve duty, but he was around. He was full-fledged player in his rookie year.
That's amazing that, you know, that's Red. You know, like, that's the he's a guy that steps in and drafts people when other teams might not. He's a guy that will pull whatever stunt he needs to pull to get the guy that he wants. And he's a guy that knows people that can pull whatever he pulled to get JoJo to be available. You know, it's just wild that, again, going back to the luck of it all and you know, Red Auerbach coming in and just all of the things that he can do, that just makes this whole thing just so much more fun.
Go ahead. Red did in the 70s. 70s are filled with examples of Red pulling the fast one, you know, outsmarting his opposition and coming up with players that nobody thought he could ever have, who paid off.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
So JoJo is, I mean, he's again, one of the more underrated guys that the Celtics have had. We talk about Sam Jones, who may be the most underrated. JoJo White, I think, is probably the second best point guard in Celtics history. When you look at the entirety of his career, all of the stuff that he could do, score, like all of that stuff, like this youth movement that starts in 1969, 1970, that whole thing, getting JoJo White in for that would be his rookie season. Getting him and pairing him with Chaney, it's such a perfect combination. Even though they missed the playoffs that year, you could see with those guys the way they play off each other, the fit, it was, even though you had to take a step backwards, this was a very quick turnaround, all things considered, in NBA timelines.
Yeah, the Cheney and JoJo did have good synergy. They played well off each other, but neither one of them was a point guard, classic point guard. They were both more combo guards where they could both handle the ball. JoJo was the shooter, though. A thing about JoJo, he came out of the 1969 draft, NBA draft, and that produced two Hall of Famers, JoJo and Kareem. So the Celtics did pretty well to pick him up when they did.
Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say that, the Celtics did miss the playoffs that year. It was just a weird situation for Celtics fans not being able to root for them in the playoffs. I remember having to root for, you know, you watch a game, you want to have a rooting interest. So you had to pick somebody to root for. And, it wasn't easy, but I rooted against the Knicks. I even actually rooted for the Lakers over the Knicks in the finals because they did play each other. Because I didn't hate the Lakers as much as I hated the Knicks back then.
It's so wild to say that because right now that seems like – I don't know what I'd pick, but just saying like rooting for the Lakers would be like – I mean, blasphemy.
Well, but not back, now.
Right.
Not now.
But back then, we talked about it in the last podcast. Back then, there was nothing to be concerned about with the Lakers. You're like, actually, I can see it because they had just beaten the Lakers so often. You're like, all right, if we can't win it, like, that'd be nice if they won one. That's fine. Which they didn't. You know, the Knicks won it.
Right. In hindsight, I'm glad it worked out the way it did.
That's true.
Jerry West was then 0-for-7 in the finals. I mean, seriously, I don't know how he ever dealt with that. I mean, that must have been so demoralizing. But anyway, the Celtics not only were down, but there were other teams coming up. The Knicks were one of the rising teams. They ended up winning two titles, and they haven't been back or barely been back. They haven't won one since then, but they did win two titles within 4 years. And you had the Bullets, which are now the Wizards. They drafted Wes Unseld, and he became Rookie of the Year and MVP in the same season.
He was good.
Yeah, and the Bullets and the Knicks had some real battles in the playoffs. And Philadelphia was still pretty good. They didn't have Wilt anymore by this point because he was in L.A., as we know. But they were still a good team. So the Celts had some competition, and that is why even the second year after Russell, when they got better, they still didn't make the playoffs. But mostly after Russell, their shortcoming was not having a center. And Red took care of that in the second year.
Yes. So in that first year, you're relying on Hank Finkel to play center. That did not go well.
Well, Hank was serviceable, but, you know, he was a backup. He was not a starting quality center. And, you know, he averaged 10 points, 8 rebounds in the first year. He didn't replace Russell. He just succeeded Russell. Nobody could replace Bill Russell.
Right.
So, you know, it was just too bad, unfortunate for him. I think the fans, you know, they wanted more out of him. He just wasn't capable of giving it. He did end up after Dave Cowens came into the Celtics. Then Hank went to the backup role that he was suited for. And then he became sort of a folk hero.
Well, let's get into this next year. So the 69-70 season obviously is a wash. 34-48, but it's really the only losing season in this transition. The Celtics go from obviously the 1969 NBA champions. They drop to 34-48, and I'm sure the entire league rejoiced. You don't have another losing season until later in the 70s when Tommy Heinsohn's run is over, and there's another transition that we'll get to later on. But the Celtics get back to winning. The second year under Heinsohn, they go 44-38. But like you mentioned, they're in the Eastern Conference, the Atlantic Division at that point. The Knicks won 52 games. The Sixers won 47 games. So 44-38, the Celtics still weren't good enough. And out west, you had the Milwaukee Bucks that were in what was then a Midwest division. And then the Lakers. The Bucks actually win a championship that year. But Dave Cowens he joins the team, and he becomes a co-rookie of the year, which is the only time that a rookie of the year was shared.
Yeah, with Jeff Petrie of Portland. The NBA had expanded. They had added Buffalo, Cleveland, and Portland. And they had a realignment where the Bucks went to the Western Conference. The NBA was a little geography challenged back in that era. And the Bucks, with Kareem and Oscar Robertson in the later stages of his career, they swept the finals against the Bullets and Wes Unseld. And even though the Celtics missed the playoffs, they were on the right track. They were going in the right direction. The pick of Dave Cowens in the draft was a little bit of a surprise for a few reasons. For one, he was not your classic center. You know, that was the big man era. Chamberlain, Jabbar, Nate Thurmond, Wes Unseld was not real tall. He was supposedly 6'8", but he was wide. So you had low post pivot players on almost every team, and they were the focus of the offense. Well, Dave Cowens came in. He wasn't seen as a center. He was 6'8", but he wasn't necessarily going to post up the big guys. And there was some question, was he going to do the job for the Celtics, or was he going to be like a power forward? And then another thing was that he played at Florida State, and they were on some kind of probation, and they didn't play in the NCAA tournament. So nobody was really familiar with Cowens. Well, when Red picked him, they were not sure. Fans, media were not sure what to expect. Well, it turned out that he was basically the first small ball center.
This is amazing.
Because the Celtics under Tommy naturally were a running team. Every chance they had, they would fast break. And Cowens had a good outside shot. He could pull up as a trailer on the break. He could fill the lane. He had hops. He was an intense defender. He could actually match up with guys like Jabbar and hold his own.
Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Lockdown Celtics on Instagram.
So, Tommy Heinsohn, here's a quote from Tommy Heinsohn. He says, I immediately said, wow. I should do this in the Tommy voice. Wow, this guy is a bundle of energy and ferocity. say he had the ball, he'd make Wilt come out, and it's a style that was very, very successful for us. So the Celtics, and I've called Tommy Heinsohn an innovator. Like, I don't think he gets the credit for the innovation that he used in the 70s, he played a style back then that is very much what the Celtics and what the NBA is today. Part of it was by just sheer circumstance where you get Cowens and you think like, all right, well, how do we use this guy? And Tommy, to his credit, was like, yeah, well, if we're going to have a 6'9 center, then let's have him face up. Let's have him pass. Let's take the other team's big. And back then, like you said, all of these dominant bigs, let's pull them out. Let's move the ball. Let's get these guys out there and make those bigs do what they don't want to do. But Cowens is excellent at doing it. This is a top-notch athlete. This is a guy who could run forever. He was just relentless. It was when he comes in, he becomes like all of these pieces now start to fit what Tommy is trying to do, which is just run, move the ball, get a bunch of shots up, and it's starting to pay off. This 1970-71 season is the beginnings of another run, and now you look at this team: Cowens, Havlicek, JoJo. Like you're looking at all of these Hall of Famers are now on this team, and they start to find some success, Mike.
Yeah, Havlicek that year averaged 29 points a game. That was his high for his career. JoJo, in his second year, up to 21 points a game. And Cowens had 17 and 15 rebounds per game. So Cowens was, I said that he wasn't your classic post-up guy, but he could post up. He had a nice jump hook. And so the fact that he could do that and go outside to shoot facing the basket made him different than the big man of that era.
Havlicek that season at 30 years old didn't just average 29 points a game. He averaged 9 rebounds, 7.5 assists, and played 45 minutes per game and played 81 games. I mean, that's the if you wanted to be the guy that said, oh, load management, John Havlicek never needed load management. Like, That's we talked a little bit about it before. Havlicek was such an anomaly because he could just run forever. He didn't need to come out. He was just fine. Like 45 minutes a game, he was fine. He was durable. And on top of it, he shot 45%. And so this is Havlicek really just showing his dominance and how he ends up becoming Boston's all-time leading scorer.
Yeah, he also talked about how he was drafted by or he had a tryout at least with the Cleveland Browns. He was going to be a wide receiver.
Yeah.
And he was the last player cut.
You tweeted that picture out.
Reported. I did. Yeah, I saw that. It was like a 1970s sports account, and I retweeted it and added some info about Havlicek, 8-0 in the finals. All-time leading scorer for the Celtics. So the Browns did him a favor by cutting him.
He
could never have had the career in football that he did in basketball.
Yeah.
And he is one of the all-time greats. Kind of forgotten about now, kind of overlooked, but he was an athlete, world-class athlete, and he's another one of the guys who could play in any era.
Yeah, you think about it. How many world-class athletes is a great way to put it, because the Celtics had a number of those guys, most notably Bill Russell, who I think, as I mentioned last week, when he was preparing to go to the Olympics and there was a question of whether he would be allowed to play due to racial issues, he was prepared to be like, yeah, I'll go compete in the Olympics in track and field because he's a world-class high jumper. And he did that weird like front jump, that flop thing, not the back thing. But anyway, the Celtics have a number of these guys. You talked about Casey Jones, who, by the way, created like bump and run coverage. Like that was his innovation. A lot of these guys who are just, maybe I'll go play this other sport profession. Like now I'll go play basketball and end up having great basketball careers. So Havlicek is the latest at this point in that mix.
Yeah. Just real quick to name a couple of others. JoJo White was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys. I don't know if he ever actually played football, maybe in high school, but he was at least drafted by them. And going way back, Bill Sharman, who played in the backcourt with Cousy. Sharman was on the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yes, that's right.
And then the most notable one, or most accomplished, is Gene Conley, who played in the 50s and early 60s in the NBA. He was with the Celtics when they won a couple of titles. And he also was on the 1957 Milwaukee Braves that won the World Series.
Huh.
He was a pitcher.
Jeez, that's amazing.
But you know, back then, that he wasn't unique by any means. I mean, Dave DeBuscher on the Knicks was a pitcher for the White Sox, I think it was. And there were a few guys. They weren't Bo Jackson quality, but there were a few guys that were multiple sport athletes.
All the way up to Danny Ainge, which we'll talk about next week. But that the Danny Ainge, the Celtics fight to get Danny Ainge off the Toronto Blue Jays is a fun story for the 80s podcasts. But that's a whole other thing. JoJo White. So I met JoJo White on my first date with my ex-wife. I was at a place called Fire and Ice, which I don't even know if those still exist, but it was in Harvard Square. I walk in, first date, we're waiting for a table, and I see at the bar wearing a full-length, like, mink coat, dressed, just pimped out like JoJo White was. I just see him. I see him with a drink, looking regal, and I'm like, "Oh my God, that's JoJo White." And so, me being the nerd that I am, on a first date, which I've said three times, because at this point I turn to my date and say, "You have to excuse me. I gotta go say hi to him," and I leave her. And I went and I said hi.
You couldn't refrain from making any bad jokes at your expense.
She still married me. I mean, we later got divorced for completely unrelated reasons. It's not like we were in court and she was like, "And the JoJo White thing." But I went up. I was lucky. When I was in college, I was coached. One of the assistant coaches was Bruce Seals, who played a little bit in the 70s, played for Bill Russell in Seattle. And so he had a career in the NBA. So I always, when I was meeting any of these 70s players, I'd be like, "Hey, yeah, one of my coaches was Bruce Seals." And that would usually get a, "Oh, how's he doing?" So that was my little in with these guys. So I would get a chance to talk to these guys and, you know, relay some of his stories that he told me and kind of like have a quick conversation. I probably talked to him for a little too long for his liking and my date's liking, but it was awesome just to see him in that moment. It, you know, he was smooth. And Cedric Maxwell has a great line about JoJo. He's like, "He's cool, not COOL with a K, cool." JoJo was known for, as much as his basketball, his delightful fashion sense.
Yes, he was just as well-dressed as Walt Frazier was. Walt Frazier was his contemporary who got a lot more publicity because he played in New York. But JoJo was, I always felt, just as good. Now, I also met JoJo White. And I
try to
spent
one-up
a little
me, will
time
you?
With him. I am going to one-up you on this. I played poker with JoJo White.
Get out!
And Steve Kaberski, who was also on the Celtics back then. This was around 1972. They lived in an apartment complex in Woburn, Mass.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know them personally, but a friend of a friend lived in the same apartment complex. And one day in the dorm where I lived, I was in college, my friend's friend was there. We were talking. He mentioned this. He said, you know, we play poker sometimes, and we need somebody, if we ever need somebody to fill in for our group, do you want to play? I said, damn right I want to play. I just want to meet them, you know. And so one time, it was a Sunday evening, my phone rang, and it was this guy, friend of a friend, who said, we need somebody to play. And so I had a car, and I had $30 to my name. I grabbed the money, and I drove over to Woburn, and I was there for like 3 hours playing poker, and I didn't do too well. I lost the whole $30. but I got to meet him, and, you know, I didn't make that much out of it. I didn't want to be a geeky fan. I wanted to be a little cooler than that. So, I didn't make a big deal. Oh, you're JoJo White and you're Steve Kaberski. But, I do remember that when I ran out of money, JoJo asked me if I needed some paper, meaning do you want a loan? Yeah. But I turned him down. I didn't want to get into hock more than I already was. So, but that was my JoJo White story.
That's amazing.
And my best friend, Joe, who we started out together being Celtic fans, as I talked about last week, JoJo White is his favorite player of all time. And so, of course, when I got back to my dorm, I called him and told him what had just happened, and he refused to believe me.
And there's no way to take a selfie to say, hey, I can prove it.
Not then. Not in 1972.
Oh, my God. That is amazing. Okay. Wow. That's unexpected. How about that? How about being a college kid and... getting called to a poker game where JoJo White, and then JoJo White floats you alone. Oh, man. Wild times. Again, 1972. That's just, it was a fun story. So up next, tomorrow, we get into the Celtics returning to the playoffs, getting back to where they're supposed to be, but heartbreak, letdowns, some bad luck, a little bit of bad luck for once for the Boston Celtics. You know, they've been pretty blessed up until this point, and there's finally some bad luck that goes along with the Boston Celtics story, and they struggle to get to where they should be, but ultimately they do win two titles in the 1970s. So that's coming up tomorrow, so please subscribe if you are not subscribed already. Please do that. And a good 5-star rating, a good written review. Very, very helpful as we continue the podcast for you Monday through Friday. It's free. It's daily. It's still here to give you a little slice of normalcy to get you through a very different and difficult time for everybody. I know that it's tough. So I really do sincerely thank you for continuing to stick with the podcast. And if you can, if you want to share the podcast, I've seen a few of you do it on social media. That is very, very, very helpful. And I really am very thankful for that. So please do that. Share the podcast. Tell people that they should be listening to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network.